welcome to the National Center on Elder Abuse podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about medication abuse, overuse, underuse, misuse, and how that relates to elder abuse. My name is Laura Mosqueda. I'm a family physician and geriatrician, and I'm the director and principal investigator of the National Center on Elder Abuse, which is funded by the Administration for Community Living. I am also the director of the Los Angeles Elder Abuse Forensic Center based here in Southern California. And I'm a professor of family medicine and geriatrics here at the Keck School of Medicine of the University of Southern California. I'm really pleased to be part of this mini series focusing on different topics, highlighting the relationships between opioid misuse and elder abuse. But as you'll hear today, we're really going beyond that and talking about how medications are misused as a form of elder abuse. I'm so happy to be joined today by my colleague and friend, a physician assistant, Teresa Sivers Teixeira. She is a practice partner of mine. We see patients together. We do research together, teach together. So it's wonderful to have her on board. And thank you to the audience for joining us for this third podcast in NCEA's mini series of podcasts. Well, Teresa Sivers Teixeira, as I said, is a physician assistant. She specializes in geriatrics. She practices person-centered care for older adults and their care partners. She's an education advisor and a professional educator for the National Center on Elder Abuse and a faculty member in the Department of Family Medicine at the Keck School of Medicine of USC. Her research interests include elder mistreatment and interprofessional geriatric education. Her current research projects include the California Adult Protective Services Interview for Decisional Ability, RCT, randomized clinical trial, which is funded by the Administration for Community Living. She's involved in the National Collaboratory to Address Elder Mistreatment, funded by the John A. Hartford Foundation. The Abuse Intervention Prevention Judicial Project, funded by the Department of Justice, and the Geriatric Workforce Enhancement Project, funded by HRSA. So she has a lot of tongue-twisting things that she does, but I'm really thrilled to be joined by her today and to be interviewing her a little bit. So Teresa Sivers Teixeira, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for that great introduction. And for your wonderful tongue-twisting list of my involvements, we can't make any titles that are shorter than 4 or 5 or 10 words.
Right. It almost took up the entire podcast. So let's just dive right in.
Okay, great.
I think I'll just start by asking you to explain a little bit how medications can be used and misused when it comes to elder mistreatment, kind of the big picture of this.
Sure. Well, I think one of the most important things to remember is that as we age, you know, physiologically we change, and older adults are just more vulnerable and more sensitive to the side effects of medication, like confusion, sedation, dizziness, and you know, when they're not dosed or used properly, then they can become extremely dangerous and toxic. You know, sometimes medication misuse can happen unintentionally. It might be an isolated incident or, you know, a lack of education. But when there's an extended pattern or purposeful misuse of medication, that's elder abuse. And I can go into more about, you know, medication's powerful, is really powerful. It can be used as a weapon or a tool of control, really. You know, overuse, underuse, misuse, they also can be forms of abuse.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's such a good point that you're bringing up that older adults are vulnerable to side effects and medications. So talk a little bit more about how you figure out if this was just kind of an unintentional mistake, people just weren't educated about it, versus something more purposeful.
Yeah, I think that that's really important because we don't want to jump to a conclusion that isn't warranted. You know, elder mistreatment there are a lot of complex dynamics and there are a lot of things to consider. And so I know that when I'm faced with something, trying to figure out a situation, let's say somebody comes into clinic, one of our patients, and it's a patient and we know their medication, we know what's been prescribed, and they're unusually, you know, really, really significantly drowsy and far beyond what any sort of medical thing could cause. And once we have worked up, there isn't some new medical issue that could cause that. One of the things that we need to think about is medication involved, is medication misuse involved? And so I think I like to think about it using a framework that you and Bonnie Olson taught me, one that you were very involved in coming up with based on all your experience. And it really breaks down, makes a framework, it really separates things into three different buckets or three different domains. And by looking at those domains and kind of the interplay of those things, it really helps me try to figure out what is the level of risk for mistreatment. Some of the domains are really three main domains. It really has to do with the older adult. How vulnerable is the older adult? Meaning, and much of that vulnerability comes from their level of dependency. Are there challenging behaviors might make it difficult to take care of the older adult? Is there a level of dependence because of physical frailty or cognitive impairment? These things are really important because if somebody needs help bathing, dressing, getting to the bathroom, that's a big job for a caregiver. If somebody is agitated and, for example, might get their caregiver, these are things that increase the risk of vulnerability and increase the risk of mistreatment for the older adult. The other bucket or the other domain that we look at is the family member, the trusted member, the person who's entrusted with care of the older adult. And sometimes there can be multiple people involved, but it's important to know what's their level of dependence on the older adult. Are they financially dependent? Are they emotionally dependent? Are they doing this because this is the place to live? And they don't have any other place to live. They don't have a family. Were they the ones that got stuck with the care of the older adult? That wasn't something that they came to willingly. They happened to be the only adult child who didn't have a family or a full-time job. These are all things that might predispose that trusted caregiver to maybe be somebody who might not always have the best interest of the older adult. And then we always have to look at the context of the relationship. Has this been a good relationship throughout the life of the older adult and often the adult child? Are they all alone? Are they isolated? Are they isolated geographically or even familially or in the community? Are there any other sorts of resources of support? You know, so by looking at all of these things, it can kind of, you know, you look at these things and you ask questions. So I know when we're in clinic, we often, and there's some concern for some form of mistreatment, it's really common for us to separate and one of us take the caregiver, one of us take the, you know, talk to the older adult and ask questions regardless of level of cognitive, can, you know, ask them, how are things going? How's it going with the caregiver? Is anybody hurting you? Is anybody making you feel bad? The sort of questions that we ask and get a sense of things. At the same time, it's important to ask the caregiver, you know, how is it going? And often we know that caregivers really tell us, you know, this is really hard and I'm so frustrated. You know, sometimes they push me, I push them back. Caregivers and studies have really shown that many caregivers can tell you that they are pushed to the limit.
Well, so it sounds like what you're saying is that when there's a suspicion of medication abuse, you're not just looking at the use or misuse of medications, but you're having to look at this in a much larger framework. Is that right?
Yeah, that's definitely right. I think some of the other nuts and bolts things, you know, that we certainly do is we look at, you know, how much of the medication is being used, how often are we prescribing it? And I think it's not always in clinic that we deal with medication misuse. Also, when people are in long-term care settings or skilled nursing settings, often find that particularly medication that's used to sedate that is intended to reduce sometimes agitation can be overused to sedate. And that's what, you know, we call chemical restraint. But even well-meaning and often well-trained professionals that are working, nursing, overtaxed, and otherwise, often are not comfortable And they have the burden of taking care of them, taking care of an older adult who has agitated and lots of demands. It can be easier from the point of view of the staff to have somebody be more sedated, more cooperative. It won't take quite as much work to take care of them. But alternatively, I sometimes have caregivers who have known somebody over time, and as things change, particularly with cognitive impairment and things like hallucinations, increased agitation come up, there's less comfort in just taking care of the person that they don't know as well anymore. And I think this is true for paid caregivers as well as family members. And so sometimes there's the sense of, once again, making them be quiet because they'll be more comfortable. When often, I think sometimes it's about the caregiver, professional or otherwise, being more comfortable.
So, I mean, we know that there are some like caregivers who are feeling like they're getting abused, right? They're getting hit. Mm-hmm. This person's acting really bizarrely. And so is it then okay for them to give medication to sedate the older adult? Or when do you think of it as starting to be abusive?
I think once again, it's abusive once it becomes a pattern. I think it's abusive. I think that what's needed in the case of somebody who feels like this is the only way, the caregiver, this is the only way I can cope with my life, that in many senses, that's a cry for help, or I think of it that way. And I think that we as providers and interprofessionally need to go in, we need to provide education that no, that isn't appropriate use. I think we have to be very clear about that. And then we have to find out what the reasoning is for it. And if the reasoning is authentically, I'm overwhelmed, I can't deal, then we need to figure out and work with them to try to get more support. It can be, formal in forms of paid caregiving or otherwise. We need to provide education and support. However, if that continues, that isn't an, unintentional misuse, that becomes abusive.
And got it. So, all right, we'll give you a shot and give you the benefit of the doubt, but now we've explained stuff to you and it's still going on for you. That's when you're like, something's wrong here.
Yeah. Yeah. And also as mandated reporters, there are legal actions that we take, but there are also different ways that we need to think about what other resources does the family member have. And also, I think when there's something like that going on, I think that it raises, it's a flag, and it's a flag that it might not only be medication misuse that's going on. There might be other forms of mistreatment that are going on.
Yeah. Well, before we get to that, when I think you're moving us toward polyvictimization, I'm just curious, what are some of the things that give you a tip, like maybe there's some medication abuse going on here?
I think that when medications are getting refilled too quickly, particularly ones that have psychoactive components to them or sedating or make somebody drowsy. I think when there are falls that occur and there's a potential for there was a lack of stability and dizziness, was there too much medication on board? I think that sometimes we can see uncontrolled chronic disease as the other thing. There are other ways. It doesn't always have to be a psychoactive medication that's being misused. I think particularly, when we start to get people using medication as a weapon and power of control, I think the withholding of medication, for severe pain, for example, somebody who has severe pain that's out of proportion with the level of medication that you've provided to support them through and help them get through those times of difficult pain. If that medication is going away and there's still extreme pain, then maybe they're not getting that medication. And I know I must be there. There are other things that I'm not thinking of. Oh, and chronic disease. When somebody says, somebody who has Parkinson's that needs their medication to help them be more mobile, and all of a sudden they're in bed all of the time because they aren't mobile anymore and you're noticing that there are pressure ulcers forming. I mean, there are lots of, it can present in multiple ways other than somebody just being drowsy.
Yeah, well, it's such a good point that I think typically when we think about medications and elder abuse, we think about over-medication, but you're pointing out that withholding medication or under-medication can also be a form of medication abuse.
Absolutely.
So it sounds like you use this AIM model, the abuse intervention prevention model, to kind of expand out from just the medications itself when you're trying to figure out what else might be going on that could indicate that there is abuse or neglect going on. And that you were also hinting earlier that it's not uncommon if medication is a form of abuse, that there's other types of abuse going on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I think that that's really true, that when there's medication abuse, purposeful medication abuse, it's often a tool, it can be a tool for coercion, whether it's withholding medication in order to force somebody to sign documents. I'm going to withhold this pain medication, for example, until you sign these checks, Dad, to use it as if somebody that is using it to sedate somebody so they're more cooperative or easier to take care of, might also be locking an older adult in the room and leaving. There might be a lot of neglect that's going on. And commonly that would be something, if that were happening, that would be high on my profile for types of abuse to look for. These things come together, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, in that first example, you know, I'm not going to give you this medication until you sign this stuff over. That's medication abuse, financial abuse, and emotional abuse going on there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So when it comes to physical abuse concomitantly with medication abuse, what might that look like?
Well, I think that, for example, somebody who is, we can use the example that I may have used earlier, somebody who is not able to be physically mobile anymore, either by deprivation of medicine that makes it easier for them to move, for example, in the case of somebody who might have Parkinson's disease, that sort of withholding so somebody isn't mobile, who stays in place, you know, the physical abuse, part of that would manifest, I think, in a type of neglect. So, you know, physically you would see it in the form of pressure ulcers. I also think somebody who really has a pattern of abuse like that would not necessarily stop at dealing with agitated behavior by hitting somebody or by restraining somebody, holding somebody down, forcing somebody to, you know, get in the shower, tying them down, tying them to a chair. See these things. It's tragically sad and a crime. You know, everybody has the right to be treated with dignity. I mean, it's our right as human beings. And then to have often somebody that you trusted or somebody who is close to you abuse a person in that way is truly humanity at some of their lowest points. So,
yeah. Well, as we're wrapping up, there's a few really important lessons I think you've given us. The idea that to look for a pattern, you know, if you have a sneaking suspicion to keep an eye on it, you provide education, it's still not getting better, and then a pattern emerges. I also hear you saying, like, we need to think about this and have it on our radar because it's easy to miss, and that we have to understand the context in which it's happening, and that we have to look for other types of abuse when we see medication abuse going on. Did I get kind of some of the main points you made? Is there anything in closing that you might want to add?
No, I think that you have it. I think I just want to emphasize for all of us and all our professions that, and in our lives with the older adults that we come into contact, if you have a sneaking suspicion that there's something going on, you really do need to pursue that. You do need to think about that. You need to be mindful and careful, but it's happening all the time and going unnoticed by people who either don't know or are not comfortable with having that conversation. And I'm thrilled that I get to work with you and leaders who've taught me all of this. You know, it's such important work, and you're such an amazing leader that's made such a big difference in the field and is making the world a better place for older adults.
Well, it's very, very kind.
I'm glad to be on the ride.
Yeah, it's great. I think the other thing you're pointing out is the importance of a team approach, how we all work together and help each other figure things out when we think something is going offline. So the teams, as is true in all forms of geriatric medicine, are really important when it comes to elder abuse and suspicions about medication abuse as well. I really appreciate you giving us this primer on overuse, underuse, misuse of medications and how that ties in to elder abuse. So, Teresa Sivers Teixeira, wonderful physician assistant, thank you so much for joining us on our podcast today.
Thank you, Laura Mosqueda.